that he and Sami are over, but he's actually still in love with her. In the spy world, this lie is profoundly compromising, and it sets in motion all manner of trouble. You see, not only is he training a young woman agent, played by Saura Lightfoot Leone, for an undercover job in Tehran, he's helping endangered assets in Ukraine. If Black Dove's gallops forward like a racehorse, the agency is quieter and more precise, like dressage. Although I've only been able to preview the first few episodes, the show closely follows the Bureau's template. It carefully lays out the agency's daily life, with its strong personalities, office politics, and murky missions. Then it starts tightening the screws of suspense. Like most spy stories, the agency taps into our modern obsession with identity. As Martian tries to juggle his romantic passion and his sworn duty, the show offers a heightened version of something universal. The gap between our public selves that act in the world and who we feel we really are inside. For all their differences, Black Doves and the agency address the same fundamental questions. Can you be a spy and still keep your humanity? At what point does your mask become your actual face? And at what point, if any, do you start saying no?
John Powers reviewed Black Doves and the Agency. If you'd like to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like this week's interview with a great blues musician, Jerron Paxton, who brought and played his instruments, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews. And to find out what's happening behind the scenes of our show and get our producers' recommendations for what to watch, read, and listen to, subscribe to our free newsletter at whyy.org/freshair. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Monique Nazareth, Susan Yukundi, and Anna Bauman. Our digital media producers are Molly C.V. Nesper and Sabrina Siewert. Thea Challoner directed today's show. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
Listener-supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, December 5th, 2024. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Cheesh, Hawa, Toyasik Newsom, Salama. Thank you for joining the conversation. Today, we chat with Ree Nankero, an art quilter from Fairbanks and the next artist in the Alaska State Museum's Solo Artist Exhibition Series. Also, we talk with Bailey Williams, whose new book, Hollow, A Memoir of My Body and the Marines, is making national impact. Bailey will have a reading and Q&A here in Juneau next week. And it's the 15th annual Pet Food Drive, which starts Monday, December 9th. We catch up with Grateful Dogs of Juneau and find out how you can participate. Those conversations, plus Tongass Voices, coming up this hour on Juneau Afternoon.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Auk Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. This Friday, the Alaska State Museum continues its solo artist exhibition series with the opening of Sharing the World I Know. It's a new exhibition from Fairbanks art quilter Ree Nankero. The exhibit will continue through March 15th. The exhibit will have an opening reception during Gallery Walk from 4:30 to 7. That's Friday, December 6th. And on Saturday, December 7th, Ree will give a talk at noon at the APK Lecture Hall. For more on all of it and the entire solo exhibition series and everything happening at the museum, you can go to lam.alaska.gov. I am joined now in studio by Ree Gunathcheesh for being here. Ree, hi.
Hello.
Great. And also Jackie Manning, curator of exhibitions for the museum. Welcome, Jackie.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us.
Okay. So, Jackie, let's start with you. This is part of the solo exhibition series we had on the previous artist, which I think that show is still up, right?
Yes. Okay. Joel Isaac's show, Honoring the Ordinary, is up into January.
Into January. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then we have another artist opening up in February, Tamara Wilson. And, yeah, every couple of years we open up a call for solo artists from around the state to apply to have a show at the State Museum. And Ree is one of six that was selected for this 2024 through 2026 solo artist series.
So this solo artist series covers two seasons in a sense,
two
right?
Two seasons,
okay,
yeah.
I see. That's really cool. And so will there be three this year and three next year? Is that how it works? Or does the timing depend on the artist?
The timing depends a little bit on our schedule, what all we got going on. But we usually try to do it every couple of years. And I try to do it a year out because to fill a gallery space can be daunting. And we want to give artists at least a year heads up if they're that first artist in the lineup to produce work for a show.
That's so cool. And, of course, tomorrow is Gallery Walk. One of the stops on the trolley tour is the museum.
Yes.
So is there stuff going on in addition to Ree's opening reception?
Yes. So we also so Joel Isaac's show is still up, and then Lou Logan is going to be in working on his Inupiaq-style kayak, and we've moved him into another gallery so he could continue to work on his kayak in there. And we also, there are nine vendors that are going to be in the atrium area of the APK, as well as Woodwinds Juno Community Band is going to be performing starting at 5:30 in the atrium.
Whoa, okay.
We've got a lot going on.
So
yeah.
The nine, what is that again? What is that going to be?
So for Gallery Walk, there's a variety of different vendors that in the atrium will be selling their artwork.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
That's great. What a great stop. And, of course, it is part of the trolley. We did a whole Gallery Walk preview on yesterday's show. You can check that out online at kto.org with a bunch of different artists and the Jack and everybody talking about overall what's happening tomorrow. It's such a big event, such a great end-of-year way to get into the spirit and really sort of promote the arts here in Juneau. It's pretty great.
It's, you know, it's an exciting time, and we could not have, you know, three more exciting shows happening at the museum. So please make the museum one of your stops. And Ree's show, I will just for a minute say these art quilts, there's some that are quite large. So as you come in there, it's really an impressive show.
That's really cool. And it's called Sharing the World I Know. So Ree, tell us a little bit about what we're going to see in this show. And then I want to talk a little bit about your history and things like that. But what are we seeing in this show that you have here in Juneau?
Well, I've been interested in natural history my whole life, and I've been involved with working with scientists for the past 10 years. And it's part of an ITOC and Time of Change program, and you're accepted as one of the artists. You spend a year or two working with scientists, and then you complete a piece at the end of that time with the new knowledge that you have. And it has changed completely the way I look at the world. Because now, you know, you looked at it and evaluated it in terms of space and shape and color and so on. Well, now, first I look at the world and go, oh, I wonder what's been happening here in years past. What's altering this landscape right now at this point in time? What's going on underground? And so it's been very, very fun to grow in this way. And I have lately learned to do some of my designing digitally on the computer, and that's opened up an entirely new world for me. And some of the pieces in the show have been developed that way, and I'll be talking a little bit more about how that has changed and you know, how I've made that change in just in the last couple of years.
I see. Okay. Well, let's talk about this art quilting, because you know, a lot of people think of, and they're on the wall, they're to be hung and viewed as art. Whereas a lot of people who quilt are quilting like, you know, they're getting one from their grandmother to be a blanket or something like that that goes on the bed. Tell me about the difference between a quilt like that versus something like a piece of art quilt.
Well, quilts actually run the full gamut from the very traditional quilts, the old time quilts, to what I do. And there's a whole, you know, interim in between, you know, there's and people produce beautiful things at each level. I have an art background. I have a degree in art education, and I have a background in, I've done a tremendous amount of drawing. I made limited edition silkscreen prints. I did a lot of taking drawing classes and so on. So I have an art background. And that immediately, once I started, you know, working on quilts, I launched into the art end of things. And so my pieces are really art pieces for the wall. I like doing quilts because I love the surface texture that it adds. Those, the linear lines on them, they change the way you look at the piece and how your eye is guided. But there's also a texture on that you can't get any other way. And I've tried watercolor. I tried, you know, doing painting and so on. And I like it. But it doesn't. I mean, I get really excited when I'm working with fabric.
Is it something about the tactile feel of working with
that? That's part of it.
Yeah.
That's part of it for sure. I mean, I've sewn my entire life. I, you know, grew up making all my own clothes when I was junior in high school, making all my own clothes. And I made all my kids' winter gear. I lived remotely in the center of Alaska when my kids were growing up, and there were no kids' clothes to be purchased. So I made all their mukluks and mittens and snow pants and that kind of thing. So I have done a lot of sewing in my life. But now I'm, you know, doing it. I'm not doing that stuff anymore. I'm just making art.
That's kind of great. And so where did you – it sounded like you got started in terms of sewing. When did you know that it could become like an art form for you that you
It was in the 90s. My sister had tried to talk me into quilting before, and I said, I'm not going to cut perfectly good fabric apart and sew it back together again. Well, so then my son started a desktop publishing business. My sister and my mom and I made a quilt for his lobby, and that launched me. I'd been making, I hand-spun dog fur and needle-pointed it into wall hangings. My husband made wooden pieces, and we made very small, beautifully crafted pieces. But all of a sudden, with this new technique, I could do things that were large. I could do things that were in bold colors. I was just hooked right there.
Wow. That's amazing. And what materials are you using in terms of, is there different materials that you're using in terms of quilting?
Absolutely. When I first started, I took many classes from national artists and learned how they work with fabric. And over time, I got interested and started to make my own fabric. I did immersion dyeing. I learned every way there was to make surface design on fabric. And gradually I have been using all my own fabric. But recently, now I've been using some of those techniques digitally, and I'm having the designs that I make sent out and having them printed commercially. So the fabrics come back, and then I sew them together and do the quilting on top of them.
Oh.
So it's a real change over time and each time I can do something more exciting than the last, something that really energizes me.
Interesting. Okay. And where are you getting inspiration for the pieces from? You were talking a little bit about the sort of the outside world, things like that. Is that where you're drawing a lot of your inspiration from?
I get inspiration when I walk out the back door, when I've been at the museum looking at things that are going on over there. I think at the end of any day, I could sit down and come up with an idea that I would be really excited about, you know, doing. So ideas have never been my problem.
Yeah. And how many layers, I'm curious about, I'm always curious about how artists see the work before it's created. So you're seeing something that's inspiring you. Let's say you step out the back porch and you see a landscape or you see the colors, you know, falling a certain way. How do you then translate that from what you're seeing into this quilted piece of art?
So many fabric artists make their design and they draw it out, and then they take fabric and they put it into each one of these pieces. I work organically. I make units, and I have my design on the wall, but I make units and I put them in different places, and I move these units around so that I am working up to the very end of the piece, making sometimes monumental decisions right at the very end. And it allows you to make changes along the way that you go with this idea and you go, oh my gosh. Mm. What my biggest piece over here is a commission that I did for the Park Service. And I had been working on that for about a month. And I went, oh, I could show the seasons. So this, it's a 7 foot high by 12 foot wide quilt. And you start at the left, and it's late winter, and you'll go across from left to right. You go into spring, summer, fall, and early winter again. And I was able to make that change because I kept everything loose right up until the end. So I can come up with these really exciting ideas, and I don't have to wait to the next piece to do it because I'm working organically on the piece.
I see. That's so interesting. So now that you're transferring some of that visual work where you would be having it tactile on the board, let's say, with different units like you were talking about, and now you're using the computer a little bit more, are you still having like units of images on the computer and you're moving them around before you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I actually, my son has helped me do some of this, and I set up, I've got the biggest monitor on the market, and I have, you know, pieces of fabric that I cut out, you know, with my, whatever you call it on the computer, and then I'm actually piecing it. And sometimes it's a large piece, and I have to take sections of it and have those sections printed, and then they come back to me, and I sew them together. So it's not, I don't piece them together. I'm just, you know, taking these large pieces and putting them together. But sometimes they aren't exactly what they I thought they were going to look like, and I have to go in and make changes in them. So it's not a done deal. And the quilting adds something to them that just was not there before. I can take a piece and make it totally something else the way I quilted.
That is really cool. Now, you mentioned this program, In a Time of Change. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
It's a program. It happens every 2 to 3 years. Artists apply to be in the program, and then there's a certain subject matter, and you work with scientists who are doing field research in that particular field. So you work with them for a year or two, and then armed with this new knowledge about this thing that you were interested in, then you produce artwork that's, you know, it's changed because you know so much more about it than you did before. And I have to say, it's been so fun working with scientists because in some ways, a scientist goes at their work the same way an artist does. Mm. I did a presentation at a microbiology conference, and I talked to a guy sitting behind me, and we talked about how we worked. And we finished talking. He got up. He had a PhD and a string of letters behind him. And I thought, my gosh, I'm talking to this guy on the same kind of level because we kind of work the same. Mm. It's been really fun. Scientists are really dedicated to what they're doing, and they are very fun to share what they do with.
That's awesome.
With artists.
And is that part of what your talk will be on Saturday about?
I'll be talking about that as part of it, yes.
Yeah. So what else will your talk on Saturday be including?
I'm telling people how my work has changed over time, but there's a continuum that runs through the whole show. And I start right out showing what I did in college. I have a degree in art education, and I have I specialized in printmaking, which is intaglio and woodcuts. But then I immediately learned, and I also have almost a master's degree in botany. So I started out making drawings of those things. And I just go through these different things that I've gone through, the things that I have learned, because each thing I have learned, first, it inspires me to create new work at the time because I can say something in a way that I've never been able to say it before. But then it just keeps going on. Then I learn another technique, and these things build. And so now I can go back. I did a whole series of fireweed quilts, and the main images that I used, I did those drawings in 1965.
Wow.
And way back, my second year in Alaska. And so I'm going to show pictures of that so that you can see how things that I did years ago, I can do different things with these ideas and things that I've done before.
That's
awesome. It is almost so much fun it should be illegal.
Reed and Kara will be talking on Saturday at the APK Lecture Hall at noon, and her show opens tomorrow night at the Alaska State Museum. It is part of the solo exhibition series. It's called Sharing the World I Know. Ree is from Fairbanks, and she's an art quilter, and it was such a pleasure to get to meet you. And the show runs through
mid-March.
Okay.
And just a reminder, First Friday is free at the museum, and the talk is free, of course, as well.
Right, absolutely. That's so great. Well, Gunnith Chiefs, for being in here today. Ree, it's really nice to meet you. Jackie, always good to see you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Up next, Junoite Bailey Williams has recently published Hollow, a memoir of my body in the Marines. It's described as brutal, riveting, and a wry gut punch, and has been making waves nationally. She'll have a local reading and Q&A in Juneau next Tuesday. You're listening to KTOO. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Clan Edi have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Next Tuesday, December 10th, the Douglas Library is hosting a talk and Q&A with author Bailey Williams. Bailey's book, Hollow, A Memoir of My Body in the Marines, is out, and Publishers Weekly calls it a staggering achievement, illuminating and infuriating. Some describe it as a story about a female Marine struggling with an eating disorder, but that only scratches the surface. It's about identity, expectations, danger, what and how we define ourselves, and how we can find inspiration to find new meaning to that question, who am I? Her book is having an impact. It's no surprise that you may have heard Bailey last week on NPR's Fresh Air, sharing her story with a national audience. It's a pleasure to welcome to Studio 2K Bailey Williams. Gunnith Chish, Ha Yigudi, thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure to have you here. Was Iti, how's it going, Bailey?
Gunnith Chish, thank you so much for having me.
It's great. It's an amazing story, and I have so many questions. I am going to link to the Fresh Air episode as well. It aired a week ago Monday on the 25th. You can find it on npr.org as well, but I'll link to it on our website. And you dive in with Tanya Mosley about so much of the story and some specific examples you read from the book. I want to focus a little bit, too, on your time and journey here in Alaska, because I think that's so interesting. Now, you are here in Klinkin-Ani, and you work for the Southeast Alaska Land Trust, which is great. And what do you do for them?
I'm their outreach and development specialist, so working with getting the word out there what we're doing.
Right. Okay, that's cool. And so how did you make your way to Alaska? I know that's probably a long journey, but
for sure it is.
How did you get here?
Yeah, well, you know, I was one of those people who always wanted to live in Alaska. I had a godmother who lived in Kenai, and she was a librarian there. And my lifelong love of books, she used to send me the most beautiful Alaskana. And so all growing up, I was like, one day I'll live where the animals are. That was Alaska. And then as relevant to the book, I left the military with an injury that made it, for me, what helped was walking. Mm-hmm. And so I developed this really deep love of backpacking, and think if you love the wilderness long enough, I think you just find your way here.
I think that's true. Yeah, especially if you're into backpacking and being in the outdoors, there's really no place like Alaska, and I think there's no place like Juneau. I think that makes it what a great place to be for that kind of thing that you do. And you're working for a perfect company then, too, which is all about sort of preserving and conserving the lands, which I think is also probably fits with your milieu, as it were.
Yeah, I think reciprocity is extraordinarily important. And I had a very peripatetic 20s, just wandered and never really stayed anywhere super long. And so this is the longest I've lived anywhere. And there was just a desire or a hope to put back into the community, too.
I see. Okay. And so, and where did you grow up? Where was your youth?
Ah, yes. I am a West Virginia girl.
Okay. West Virginia. And I know it describes in the book that it talks about you escaping sort of your youth, the Mormon upbringing and jumping into the military. And I'm curious, like, how did you decide that that would be the path? What was that decision making to go into the Marines?
Escape is an intense term, but it certainly that's what it felt like when I was 17.
We have a lot of emotions when we're 17, don't we?
Truly. And that weighed into the decision, absolutely. You
know,
your prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed. But
yeah.
There was that, the boldness of youth. Like, I want to do something that will define me differently than how I know myself thus far. I want an identity that I can wear with pride. And I grew up in a very conservative family. I'd only ever really heard hero worship, had never heard any criticism on the military in any way. And it felt like I'd be joining like an honor guard or something that was, this sounds a little grandiose, but something that was morally upright.
Mm.
That was my impression of the Marine Corps.
Mm. Interesting. Mm. Yeah, obviously the book dives into a lot of that's not what it was.
There was some disenfranchisement, certainly.
There was some different things happening. Sort of give us, for those who haven't heard of the book or maybe didn't catch the Fresh Air episode, give us sort of the idea of what happens in the book, your journey. It's a memoir. It's all true. And give us a little bit of an overview so we can get context.
Yeah, certainly. So enlisted quite young, the week of my 18th birthday. I enlisted as a military linguist. So the book kind of plays on that because while I'm learning Farsi and Dari, I'm also learning lingua marine, like how we speak to each other, how we speak of violence, and in particular how, at least in my unit as an enlisted Marine, how we spoke to and about women and the women among us. And frankly, the book is in some degree my form of dissent. I don't feel like the way we spoke of each other was appropriate or it was not helpful in any way for unit cohesion or anything valuable. And I feel quite strongly that I hope my story questions some of the things that just happen commonly in the military and that happen behind closed doors, and an invitation to consider ways that we, at least within the story, I really bought into some of the stories that I heard. I really bought into the narrative of like, oh, this is what a girl's like, so I shouldn't do these certain things to be seen like this very bizarre interpretation of femininity. And so for me, the book is learning to resist external narrative and find your own story, find your own sense of identity and self-worth.
Mm. Is it sort of defining in terms of, you know, men and women in the Marines? Is it very like black and white, like in terms of, is it like, this is what a woman is, this is what a man is? And there are certain things that you can't do as a woman that a man can do, that kind of thing?
Yeah, great question. Worth noting, when we speak about women in the military, in most branches, we're just speaking about the military. The Marine Corps is an outlier. When I was serving, it was only 7% women. Mm. We've made progress. We're now up to 9%.
Ooh.
So it is and that reflects in every tier leadership. There was a moment where I realized that I did not have a single woman in my chain of command, in my leadership, from my, you know, platoon sergeant all the way up to the commandant in the Marine Corps. There was not a single woman in any kind of leadership role. And I believe that women should be in leadership everywhere, and that was no exception. And yes, and I note within the book and here that the language here is very binary, which I don't mean to reinforce, but that is certainly a structure that is very much alive at the time I was serving in the Marine Corps. And yes, recently, a few years ago, all military MOSs, all military jobs were open combat positions were open to women. At the time I was serving, that was not the case. And so there was this narrative that the ultimate example of Marinehood, like the actual warrior, the mission essential individual, was always going to be a guy. It's always going to be a man. Mm. And in my opinion and in my experience, that really led to language that valorized him. You're doing all this for him. And some of the language, because whether women should serve in combat has always been contentious, despite the fact that we've served in every American conflict since the Revolutionary War, really seeped down through the ranks. And the language of you're not as mission essential could become, I heard some extraordinarily crude and cruel things that suggested that our service was not as meaningful, not as impactful, and didn't uplift the whole unless we conformed to certain very, just like being very rigid, very cold, very shut down, displaying no emotion. And unfortunately, that kind of rigid gender prescription also normalized sexual violence. And some pretty intense victim blaming.
Yeah, I know you talk about that in the interview and, of course, in the book as well, in terms of things that happened to you. That the one instance that I was really – that the interesting thing to me is the – where you talk about the casual touching, right, where you're talking about this idea that, you know, especially if you're already in the military and you're seen as, you know – In essence, a support role. Like, you're never going to be the one, right, who's going to do the mission, as it were, as you're putting it. And, like, so if you're seen in that way, then the other people around you are being sort of trained in that way, too, to treat you that way as well, even though, even if instinctually they may have some other ideas, but they're also being sort of in this learned behavior in that instance, especially if you are in barracks or if you're in a would you call it a troop? Is that what you call it? A
platoon.
Platoon, where you are maybe the only female. Does that happen? I mean, and if that's that, like the danger sense of that as for you as a woman, how did you work with that? How did you deal with those sort of pressures?
Yeah. There's a lot of great insight in that. One that, you know, there were many people I served with, men and women, who were very cool people and very good people. And we also existed within this certain subculture.
Yeah.
And we were all learning how to fit in. We were all really young.
Right.
We talk so much about men and women in the military. We were children. Mm-hmm. Like, our leadership was 23 and 24. Like, we were very much, like, trying to figure out who we are. And so we were very vulnerable to social pressures. Add in the component that we all enlisted during wartime, so there is this kind of urgency in our day-to-day action because we are training to go to war. That is like in our bodies, like in the constant urgency and that sympathetic nervous system activation all the time. It really made it excusable to some degree to bully one another because we were just toughening each other up.
Right.
And that was often the language, and that's, again, the heart of the book is that, not really a play, but observations. As a military linguist, the language we used towards and about women's bodies was often under the guise of, I'm just kidding, I'm just joking. Mm. And if you can't take a joke, you maybe shouldn't be a Marine because you can't hack it. Mm. And unfortunately, that silencing had a rippling effect. And there was an expectation that we, as individuals, were responsible for our own safety, which is ironic given the larger military mission of like having each other's backs. That's very conditional.
Yeah, for sure. I could talk to you for hours about this. It's so interesting. How did you go through the – when did you serve? I wanted to ask that question. When did
2008 to 2011.
Okay.
So the surge into Iraq was the context.
Okay, gotcha. And so when did the idea for the book start to form for you? Mm-hmm. When did you start thinking about writing the book?
For years after I left the service, I could not call myself a veteran. It was so challenging to – I like very much hid that I'd been in the military. I felt a sense of shame because I hadn't deployed in a combat situation. Because of the enlistment that I had was just not what I had expected or anticipated. But over the years, I started to just gnaw at it in my journal and just started to writing letters to other friends in the military and other folks who had similar stories or similar experiences. And what I learned again and again was this echo: my experience was not unique. Some of the things that I experienced are not special to me. They are much bigger questions, much bigger issues. And that put a little bit of a fire under my skin of like, maybe this is something that I should look at and over time develop into a story.
What's it been like to be, I mean, the book came out recently.
Yes.
Last month. What's it been like to have it, have your story out there and be so open about everything that's gone on with you?
You know, a really pleasant surprise. I always knew, even writing it, that it was going to be controversial. I feel like there's a strong proclivity. We want our folks either want their war stories to be to align with a certain narrative, right? Like, we're the good guys and we do great things and every dollar you spend in the military is going to a justified cause, or not. You know, that's kind of the expectation of a lot of military writing. And so I knew that if you don't follow that party line, you say like, hey, there's some major issues within the military, other memoirs that have questioned some of the decision making and policies within the military from a personal perspective have also received criticism and are charged with being anti-military, with being anti-American, unpatriotic. And so I always expected that. I always anticipated that's just going to happen. But the really beautiful and pleasant surprise is the overwhelming amount of love and support that I've received, both from like my closest family and friends and increasingly on like a national level, like people reaching out and saying like, this validates the experience I had, or I feel heard or seen, or just, you know, thank you for trying to put light in a really dark place. And so it's actually been a, yes, very vulnerable, very strange experience. Imagine if your high school diary was published because I was 17. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
And a couple years ago, I realized like, wow, this is a time in my life where I was, you know, there's angst. There's a lot of angst.
And there's a lot more that we're not talking about right now on the show, but that the book goes into the eating disorder, it goes into a rape assault that you had, and other things. There's
just the dysfunctional ways I tried to manage the pressure.
Yeah, all
very
that.
Maladaptive. Yeah.
So, what is your hope that someone might take away from reading the story?
Of course, I hope to reach other women who've served who have never really been able to make sense of the experience, where you kind of have an ambivalent relationship with it, where you want to be proud of your service, you want to be proud that you tried something hard and tried to make a difference in a positive way, but you didn't have a very positive experience, and that's just what it is. So of course there's a certain subset of fellow women that I would love to connect with. However, for a more general audience, the heart of the story is questioning the stories that are given to you. You must be this way. You must conform or fit into this idea of a human. And the resistance of that, of saying that actually does not define me, that does not benefit my health, my soul, my mind, my spirit. I am crushed by that story. I will find my own. I will write my own. And I really hope, you know, with the darkness of the book, to name some of those spaces where, you know, I thought a lot of the William Blake of the mind-forged manacles, and the stories we tell ourselves that keep us stuck.
Yeah,
and
for
this,
sure.
This book is such a, I hope, a clarion call to be like, stop. question the stories that we think are true.
Well, that's what I was saying in the intro, is sort of, you know, I'm talking with Bailey Williams about her book, Hollow, A Memoir of My Body and the Marines. And, you know, I was saying in the beginning that it's you know, identity, like how do we wrap, like you have, there's a lot of words that are related to identity that define a person, that can define a person. You grew up Mormon, you were a Marine, like these things instantly have context for people and they instantly put things in people's minds about what that means, right? And for ourselves too, because we tell ourselves those stories over and over again. And so finding your way through that to, you know, now being a Junoite and being able to hike the mountains and have your dog and your cabin and all those wonderful things, like that's such a great journey, you know, to see that. I have a there's the leader of the Native Voices at the Autry, the artistic leader down there. She says stories are medicine, and from her culture, she says that stories are medicine, and I just think that's so true, you know, because when you read somebody's story, even if you don't have any connection to that. I've never been a Marine. I'm not Mormon. I'm not anything like that. But to be able to hear your story and connect to it in sort of on that human level and know and the empathy of having that, knowing sort of a little bit of your story can inspire everyone or others to say, what is that in my life? Or what can I see about this that's going on in my life? Maybe things are happening in like you're talking about, in terms of language, the things that are said around you, the things that are said about you in the workplace that you're in, those kinds of things. And you can kind of maybe open your eyes to it a little bit, you know, and maybe you haven't seen some things that, so even if you're not connected directly to your story, what I'm saying is there's a universalist, you know, universal feeling that you can see through and access it for yourself, you know, for oneself, which I think is just fascinating.
That's incredibly kind. And of course, that's the highest goal of writing, right, is to connect with people who've had a totally different experience but can still relate to being human. And that can be really hard sometimes, but there's also so much beauty and connection in it.
Now, this is your first book?
It is, yeah.
And I say first, does this mean, are you going to explore other ideas or other things about your, because this is from a period from a while ago.
Yes.
Is there other things that you want to talk about in your life that you've sort of, you know, thinking about writing into stories?
I definitely decided the next one will be a novel. There is a level of self-introspection that does get a little intense after a while.
Yeah.
But yeah, I decided, you know, when this book was going to press and just having the reality check of like, wow, some really vulnerable stories are going to be on public record and in the Library of Congress. Like, that's weird. Just like naming what my value is as a writer and my hopes for success would just be that I keep writing.
Yeah.
And hopefully, what I'm working on now is more about joy and gratitude and embodiment in this amazing land.
Yeah, I saw that on your website. And what is your website?
Bailey Williams Writes.
Bailey Williams Writes, and the .com, yeah. I'm assuming. Yeah, and people can go check that out. Of course, the book is available locally at Hearthside, things like that. And you're going to be doing a talk next week at the library. What is the talk going to be about? Is there something specific? I mean, obviously, you're going to be talking about the book, but is there anything in specific that you're going to be talking about?
Yeah. Really just talking about the book and the process of creation and that creation of narrative and creation of story. So warmly welcome my friends. I also warmly welcome other writers just for the experience of what it's like to craft your own story.
Yeah, and it's Tuesday night. It's in the evening, right?
Yeah, 6 p.m. at the Douglas Library.
6 p.m. at the Douglas Library. They'll be hosting Bailey and her book, Hollow, A Memoir of My Body and the Marines. I did want to ask this because as somebody who, you know, I know you took a long time to write the book. It began as a thing. You took some years to do it. Mm-hmm. How did you, just for people who might be interested in this part of it, the business side of it, how do you get it published? What did you do to do that?
Oh, fair question. Yeah, there are definitely different venues. I went the traditional route. I kind of just hoped for the support that comes with that. So I queried agents. I wrote a letter specific. I would look at books that I really loved. I am an avid reader. It's a little bit antisocial how much I read, but looking at books I really loved that had similar themes or similar linguistic styles even, and then I'd find the agent of that book and just crafted a query letter. And I was, this does happen. So anyone who's trying to do this right now, it's statistically implausible, but it does happen that you just do the cold letter and someone likes your writing and decides to vouch for you. And I have an amazing agent who just really stuck by my side. And then, you know, she submits to acquiring editors. And we had a couple editors who were interested. And I chose to go with a smaller publishing house because that's always been more my style. I like working more intimately with people.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just interesting because, you know, here it is, somebody who lives in Juneau who has a story and wants to write it. And then it gets published and then ends up on Fresh Air on the national program. And, you know, that's just an interesting journey to see how that works, you know. And obviously, by sharing such a personal story, to be able to do that, there's a lot of layers there, and it's just I can't imagine what that what those levels of feelings are for you in terms of this, you know, the success of this book. And I encourage everyone to get to the library next Tuesday night, the Douglas Library at 6 o'clock. It's Bailey Williams and her book, Hollow. And I really appreciate you coming on the show today. Gwyneth Cheese, for being here today, Bailey.
Oh, back at you. Thank you for your thoughtful questions.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Up next, we will chat with the Grateful Dogs of Juneau about the upcoming pet food drive. First, this week's Tongass Voices, perspectives from the homelands of the Occoquan and beyond. Ariel Estrada wrote a one-man play that's coming to Juneau this week. It's the world premiere of Full Contact, a play that stretches from his father's immigration to Southeast Alaska to teaching LGBTQ plus self-defense at a martial arts dojo in New York City. The show runs in Juneau. It opens tomorrow night, December 6th, and it runs for 3 weeks.
Performing this play in Southeast Alaska, it's so wonderful to be coming back here, back to my roots, basically. Hi, I'm Ariel Estrada, and I am the writer and performer of the play Full Contact, which is performing at Perseverance Theater December 6th through 22nd, directed by Leslie Ishii. I lived in Alaska since 9 years old. My dad was in the Coast Guard, and we transferred to Sitka, and he fell in love with Sitka, and he had to stay. And in many ways, I'm so glad that I have come back here, because there's parts of my time in Sitka that are actually reflected in the play. And the history of Filipinos in Alaska is also reflected in the play. The short version of it is that Filipinos came up here for the salmon fisheries, because there was we called them manongs, which in Tagalog means the brothers, who would travel up and down the West Coast, oranges, apples, fish, every year, because they were itinerant workers. The times when they came here in the late 19th century, there wasn't the ability to really stay in many communities, right? Because they were segregated, they were kept out of being able to actually maintain a place to stay. This, thankfully, started easing up over time, and they were able to start settling in the places that they were being migrant workers at, including Alaska, Southeast Alaska in particular. And because of that, there's a pretty significant Filipino population here in Alaska. So Full Contact is my story of being in a martial arts group, training heavy-duty, full-contact martial arts for about 20 years of my life. And they were a pretty incredible 20 years, because that was also my coming of age in New York. I'd been doing martial arts since college, and then I got really into it when I moved to New York and ended up opening up a martial arts school with some friends of mine. At the same time, I was also sort of coming of age as a Filipino person, right? Learning more about my identity as a Filipino person, also as an LGBTQIA plus person in New York. The AIDS crisis was starting to become a manageable disease for certain communities, right? And what did that mean as part of that coming of age, right? And also in that background, having this martial arts organization sort of overarching the entire experience. It's been a really amazing process being both the playwright and the performer, because I have to literally take off one hat in one moment and another hat in another. So the playwright in me will write something, and then the actor will come up onto the stage, start rehearsing it, and go, "Who wrote this? This is not working." And then I had to take off that actor hat, put on the playwright hat, and working with my director, go, "Why isn't this working? Let's rewrite it." And it's literally happening within a 10-minute span. We'll write an entirely new scene and figure out what we were working on before wasn't working, and then make it work within that 10 minutes. So it's a fast and furious process, and so much fun. It kind of reminds me of martial arts, actually. And there's so much of a collaborative process of being able to create this beautiful finite experience that people will experience live for the first time. And I strongly believe in my heart that theater can do something that film and TV can't, right? There's that immediate communal experience that only happens in a room with people in that second and in that time, and it will go away forever after that, but will live on in their hearts, hopefully, as they go out into the world and bring those lessons or that emotional journey with them as they go out into the world and hopefully make the world a better place.
That was Ariel Estrada, writer and star of Full Contact, a one-man play premiering at Perseverance Theater tomorrow night. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Starting Monday, December 9th, the Grateful Dogs of Juno is sponsoring the 15th annual Pet Food Drive. Joining me now is Pam Nelson from Grateful Dogs to share more with us. Gunathchish, Pam, welcome. Basiti, how's it going?
Hey, good. Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
Of course, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about Grateful Dogs of Juno, first of all.
So Grateful Dogs of Juno is a small core group of we formed back in 2005 when there was some dog concerns within the community of Juno, and we basically formed to be a representative of responsible dog owners to be able to go to assembly meetings and community meetings and talk about, you know, they were talking about wanting to close different trails to dogs and things like that because of problems, and it was trying to
perceived problems.
Right, yes, right. And to be representative of the responsible dog owners in Juno to say, well, no, we don't really think that's fair, or just to give people a voice that maybe they weren't individuals weren't going to go to certain meetings or things, but as a group, you know, we could represent what responsible dog owners were feeling.
I see.
You know, and we've worked with the assembly on things, and we've worked with Department of Fish and Game, you know, and the Forest Service for when we do cleanup of trails, you know, because everyone, there's always the poop question of, you know, in town. And, you know, so we work with that and trying to help keep people to be, and to teach people to be responsible dog owners, you know, to clean up after your dog, what it means to be respectful on trails with people who don't have dogs or people with other dogs, or an understanding how you should, you know, be show yourself as a responsible dog
is
owner.
Is Grateful Dogs an organization that somebody can join or be a part of?
Yep, definitely. We have a website. It's just gratefuldogsofjuno.org, and there's a membership application. It's $10. And we do things with members. We'll do, like, dog walks and things like that. We'll go on different trails. So if you're new to Juno and you're looking to, you know, want to get to know other dog owners or kind of get to know the trails, you know, dogs is, you know, Grateful Dogs is a good way to become, have that built-in group.
It also seems like if you have a, if you're a new pet owner, maybe you haven't owned a dog before, or something like that, to be able to learn etiquette and things like that. Because, you know, the perception is like, oh yeah, dog owners don't pick up the poop. And it's, that's not necessarily true, right? I mean, most do. There are a few bad apples that give dogs a bad name.
Yes.
But I also just think it's like, you know, if you have, let's say, a teenager or you're getting a dog for the first, you know, especially around the holidays, sometimes people get animals and maybe they've never had one before. It's a great place to sort of, be part of a community, right? Be part
of
a community of people who are living here in Juno and are advocates for dogs, which I think is great. So that's cool. And you can find all that detail at gratefuldogsofjuno.org. It's a wonderful organization promoting responsible dog ownership here in Juno. And this thing you do is going on 15 years.
Yes.
It's the annual Pet Food Drive. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So we started doing this back in 2010, and we were doing it around just around Christmas time is when we first started doing it. So we've continued to do a holiday pet food drive. It's blossomed over the 15 years to we supply pet food to Southeast Alaska Food Bank, the Resurrection Lutheran Food Pantry, and now the Jewish Community Food Pantry in town year-round. We will actually, you know, be able to, as supplies allow us to do it. As long as we have the supplies, you know, we will try and keep them stocked of dog food because we've been, and cat food, dog and cat food.
Don't leave out those
we
cats.
We don't leave out the cats. we may be grateful dogs, but we're going to help the cats too.
Right.
We don't discriminate.
Yeah.
but we started out just doing it around the holidays because, you know, you'd always do
they would do human food drives, you know, for the Southeast Alaska Food Bank. And, you know, I started seeing, like, down south in the lower 48, there was some, you know, food insecurity for people with their pets, and they were feeding their pets before they would feed themselves. And then right. I wondered if there was a need for that in Juneau. And, you know, we started talking to the director at the time of Southeast Alaska Food Bank, and he said, yeah, whenever we get it, it always goes. So we started just doing the holiday pet food drives, and then kind of saw that there was a need year round. So we kind of do this week around Christmas to make sure, you know, everyone is having a happy holiday and they don't have to worry about food for their pets or food for their family or heating oil or, you know, different things like that. If you can help offset that, because the food bank and the food pantries are open to anyone in town. You know, they don't ask you for what your income is or anything. You just go on the days that they're open, and you know, what you need is what you can take. And if you need pet food, you can get some pet food.
That's fantastic that they offer that, that it's not just for, because I think a lot of people think that it's just for, you know, people food.
Yeah.
But the fact that you can also, you know, support. And so this food drive is really, it's also a big food drive, but then it's also more awareness, because you do need food throughout the year, which is also good. So for this particular one, what are the details? How do we donate?
So it starts Monday, this coming Monday, the 9th, and it's running through Saturday, the 14th. And we have two drop-off locations. So one is Petco, which is basically their regular business hours, and they're open from like 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. So you can buy it at Petco and drop it off there. Petco, they don't care whether you buy it there and drop it off there. If you went to Costco and wanted to give a big bag, you can bring that in and drop it off in the drop box there. Or Juneau Animal Rescue is our other drop-off location. And they are open Monday through Saturday from 9:30 to 5:30. So anytime during those business hours for this holiday pet food drive, you can take it either to Petco or to Jar, and they will have drop boxes.
And that's great. So Jar and or Petco to drop off starting Monday, December 9th, all the way through Saturday, the 14th, right?
Yes, yep.
And what is the, if I can't make that or can't make that happen, what do I do the rest of the year? If I have some stuff that I want to get to you all, what do I do?
So you can either contact us on the Facebook, on our website. Just send us a message through Facebook, or there's an email on our website that you can send us, or you're more than welcome to call me or text me at 907-723-4088, and I will arrange a pickup. Either we'll come and pick it up from you, or arrange some place to meet up or have you drop it off to one of our members that we'll be able to get it to where it needs to go.
That's fantastic. What a great thing. And I hope that it is people are able to donate. Again, it's at Juneau Animal Rescue and then at Petco. And those are during their regular business hours.
Correct.
During those times you can drop off. And or you can, outside of next week, you could give Pam a call and give your number one more time, Pam.
907-723-4088.
You can find out information about the pet food drive plus everything else that Grateful Dogs of Juneau does at gratefuldogsofjuneau.org. Thank you so much, Pam. It's a pleasure to have you here, and congratulations on the 15th annual pet food drive. That's amazing. I really appreciate you being here. Gunnath Cheesh.
Thanks for having me.
That will do it for today's Juneau Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, Juneau Dance Theater's The Nutcracker, author Marion Elliott, and Mudroom's storytelling event is happening next week as well. Juneau Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTOO Juneau 104.3 and KAUK Juneau Auk Bay 91.7. Hello out the road. Find the show online at kto.org/JuneauAfternoon, where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, offer feedback or suggestions, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunnath Cheesh, and have a joyous Juneau evening.